Right there.
No problem. You broke it?
You broke it.
No.
Yeah,
wait a minute.
The other way around, yes. That's true. So sit down.
Final map would endure. What's the name? Phrase.
Right.
Okay, good. No problem. Is it off right? Is that good?
Yeah.
Maybe we could put it left and left.
Can we use that to?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Emma's talked about measure in catering the waitress industry. What Massimo and I want to talk about is measure generally, and we'll draw examples from higher education in the UK. I mean, we think this question of measure is fundamentally important, has relevance to how we understand the law of value and how we struggle against that, has relevance to how we understand what capital is and how we struggle against capital. People talking yesterday, Jan, immaterial labour, this labour is beyond measure, not possible to measure. Andrea talking yesterday, talking about the impossibility of measuring immaterial labour. Obviously, Hart and Negri talk about value being outside of measure. Now, we have two problems with this almost. First of all, when these theorists suggest that immaterial labour is outside of measure, kind of as an implicit presupposition that material labour was within measure, that measuring material labour was unproblematic. And we have an issue with that. And the whole project of Frederick Taylor and his co-workers, this was about measure. Taylorism was all about measure. It was about appropriating craft knowledge from workers. It was about a war over how much, how long. That's what Taylorism was about. So in a sense, that's the first problem, our first problem with understanding immaterial labour is outside of measure, because it kind of suggests that material labour is unproblematic in terms of measure. What we're really going to talk about, though, is how immaterial labour is, in fact, measured. And this slogan from management consultants, McKinsey and Company, everything can be measured, and what gets measured gets managed. And this, again, relates to something that Jan talked about yesterday. He talked about crisis of control and management of labour. And I think he's right. There is this crisis of control and management of labour. But measure is capital's attempt to resolve that crisis in its favour. Jan also talked about the role of managers being facilitating networking. Absolutely not. Sorry, you're wrong. We network. The whole thing about immaterial labour is that, you know, this is rhizomatic production. We're horizontal networks. It's us who network. What managers do is try and control our networking and measure our networking. So we think this question about measure is all about the question of how our labour is measured, or how capital attempts to measure our labour. So we're going to talk primarily about higher education, because that's where we both work for 2 decades or more, both students and paid academics. So that's what we know most about, but we think what we say is much wider relevance. So we'll talk a little about the context of higher education. Obviously, there's been massive funding crises in higher education since the 1970s and the so-called fiscal crisis state. So big struggles over funding of education, general education funding has fallen. The other context, of course, leading from the fiscal crisis state is the neoliberal project. And as part of neoliberalism, that part of the discussions at the Seattle World Trade Organization meeting was about free trade in education. It's about opening up international education markets. And this is fundamentally important. And we have all of these quotations from Charles Clark, the Education Secretary. It would be possible to opt for quiet life bask in previous successes, shirk the need for reform. It would be wrong because the world is already changing faster than it has ever done before, and the pace of change will continue to accelerate. There is no alternative. The quotation, we cannot be complacent, that's from Tony Blair. Again, saying UK education is dog's bollocks, but we can't be complacent. We've got to work more. So this is kind of context in which academics in Britain are working at the moment. And it's interesting because talking to friends and colleagues who work in universities in other countries, we're kind of talking about the conditions of our labour. And they're like, that's weird. Like, it really seems to us that the UK higher education and UK education in general is on the front line of these struggles. And that's why it's maybe particularly important. So I'll just talk for a few minutes about some of the burdens of our work, and we kind of summarise these under the headings quantification, standardisation and surveillance. So these are just a few of the examples of this quantification, standardisation and surveillance. Any university, any degree in the UK is 360 credit points. You have to get 360 credit points and then you get a degree. A university will break that 360 credit points down into, say, 620 credit point modules each year. And this is a change. When I was at university, a university just awarded a degree. Now they're kind of comparable across different disciplines and across universities. Within the degree, a module, that's, again, all this. I started putting all of these terms, modules and credit points, in inverted commas, and I have stopped because just about every other word is in inverted commas. But a module is like a course within a degree program, and every module is standardised such that a module has to be set out with a specific structure. As a person who teaches a module, you have to set out aims and objectives of the module, which of course reminds me of aims and principles, which we won't go there. You have set out the aims and objectives of the module. You have set out so-called indicative learning outcomes, i.e. what the student will know at the end of the module. And these are broken down into the subject specific, such as will understand the nature of rhizomatic cooperation in my and generic, so we'll be able to communicate orally. This is a generic, and a whole degree is made up of this list of indicative. Pardon?
Transferable
skills, exactly. So each year, at the beginning of every course I teach, I have to set out a module outline. At the end of each year, I have to write a module report, which will include some student feedback on how the module went, what I think went wrong, how it improved for next year. And of course, even if I think it went brilliantly, I have to still have some suggestions for how I can improve it next year. And I have to report on the marks that have been awarded and the distribution of marks. And you can understand the average mark as an indicator of how much work I'm imposing on students. You can understand the distribution of marks as the extent to which I'm putting students into a hierarchy. All of this is surveilled by numerous committees, both internal to the university and external. And the most pernicious is something called the Quality Assurance Agency for Higher Education, or the QAA, which conducts periodic reviews of university departments, where a bunch of examiners come in and essentially go through the paperwork. They'll read module outlines, module reports, they'll read reports from external examiners, and all sorts of stuff. Within a university, we have workload models. So, for example, I'm supposed to work at my old university. I won't talk about my present employer. My old university, I'm supposed to work 1,575 hours a year, 37.5 hours a week times 42 weeks. And for every task I performed, I had a work allocation. So if I gave a 1 hour lecture, I was allocated 3.5 hours, with the other 2.5 hours to include preparation time, dealing with student queries, and so on and so forth. If I was tutored to a group of students, I'd get 50 hours or whatever. And all of this was supposed to sum to 1575. We also have benchmarking, cultures of best practice, so on and so forth. Oops, sorry, go back. Ridiculous. Absolutely fucking mad. It's absurd. And this is what people say, and of course it's true. But it's also real. If I get 3.5 hours to prepare a lecture, and deliver it, and deal with student queries and so on, I get 3.5 hours. If I want to do something a bit more interesting, if I have some difficult students, or I want to give students extra time, if I'm just not very good at my job or something like that, I lose out. I will have to work in my own time. If I cannot meet or beat that norm, 3.5 hours, I extend my work a day.
On the matter of measure.
Through overtime.
So that measure is real. It forces me to become more efficient. And of course, if I maybe work out a better way, maybe I can do it all within 3 hours, then that's kind of, well, maybe management will say, well, that David Harvey, you know, he's good, 3 hours. And I'll say to my colleague, why can't you do it in 3 hours? So this is kind of one to try and push that down. I'll talk about it in my 5 remaining minutes. Another aspect in which these measures are real, if a department or a university doesn't fulfill certain quality assurance agency criteria, it will lose a certain amount of so-called discretionary funding. Universities or departments can get funding for fulfilling certain criteria such as improving the quality of their education, setting up centres for excellence and so on. If a department or university doesn't attract sufficient students, then it will lose money, the money that it gets for teaching students. And this means closure of courses or departments and sacking of workers. And there's a so-called crisis of chemistry and other sciences in the UK at the moment. A number of chemistry departments have been closed in recent years. And what we're saying, we think we're actually witnessing the emergence of some sort of socially necessary labour time for the work of academics. And we think the idea that the socially necessary labour time for a 1 hour lecture is 3.5 hours. Now this process is both synchronic, because through these construction of these measures it enables the comparison of my labour time with Massimo's, with another academic, and as I'll argue, with any other type of worker, and diachronic, because there are these processes of pushing down these socially necessary labour times. For example, the whole idea of best practice. Best practice always hints at a better practice. These types of measure are happening at all levels. So within a particular node, say a university, there are these workload models that I mentioned, internal reviews and quality committees. Across universities within the UK, we have competition for students, competition for these higher education funding council agreement, special funds or discretionary funds. There's competition for research funding based on another metric which we have in the UK called the research assessment exercise. We have this thing called the transparency review, in which the university is supposed to say how much time its members of staff spend on different activities. So across universities, there are this measure. And this is starting to happen internationally too. Back in 1999, there was a so-called Bologna Declaration, in which 29 countries agreed, European countries agreed to standardise their higher education models, such that degrees in Britain became comparable degrees in all these other countries. And interestingly, the way education relates to other sectors, obviously universities competing for international students also. If we understand states, different states, nation states, as competing for capital, to attract capital within their borders and then to retain that capital, then one of the key factors in attracting and retaining capital is the quality of labour power. How skilled, how compliant, how imaginative, and so on and so forth. And of course, education is a key sector in reproducing labour power. So we are competing because we're competing to attract, to produce labour power, which is then attracting capital. The other way in which we compete internationally, and in which the labour education workers can be compared, is one of the fastest growing literatures in economics. It's that literature which estimates the so-called economic returns to schooling. So, for example, econometricians do these studies and say, what are the expected lifetime earnings of a graduate vis-a-vis a non-graduate? What are the expected lifetime earnings of a physics graduate vis-a-vis a social science graduate? What's the expected effect on the GNP of the nation of so many, such and such proportion of its population having degrees? This is what econometricians are doing at the moment. They're estimating the economic value of education. Again, this is real. These studies inform UK government policy, they inform World Bank policy. And this, of course, links education to many other sectors, both of immaterial labour. Health is a big one, where we report performance indicators. Econometric studies of the economic returns to health. Innovation in production of material goods. Big literature now in management about how to measure and manage innovation. And I'll finish with this quotation again from some McKinsey management scientists. As services become an ever, you can read it. The key point is, executives should not abandon hope. And standardising the manufacture of products and services.
Okay. There is a postscript on that. After we wrote the paper and we participated in this debate, I think it's important to bring in a few issues linked to actually the paper we wrote, but also Emma's paper, Emma's point, which in a different sector and a different type of skills and conditions raised the question of measures, of ideas and effect. I think that what our papers and Emma's paper is argued in different ways and in different contexts is actually capitalism measuring ideas and effect. The measurement or the attempt, the strategy to measure ideas and effect are real, as they were real strategies to measure material production, Taylorism and all this stuff. So, and of course, in conditions completely different, with different type of class composition, different types of subjectivities involved, etc., there's no doubt that there are disruptions in that. But it's important also to emphasize the commonality there, which goes across the disruptions within the capitalist system, and the capitalist history. And it's also important to emphasize, we touched briefly upon it, Emma touched in her talk, is that as in any other space of production in which capital is involved and capital value practices are involved, there is also at the same time the production of stratification in one way or another. Either actually the type of wage production is predicated on certain stratification, but it also reproduces certain stratifications. And the other key point, which is important to us, is actually that because of capitalist measures, which of course are contested, so it's not all the race, as you know, Orthodox Marxists say, of course they are contested, it's a terrain of struggle, but their existence, their ongoing attempt to measure is actually contributing to shaping the forms of production and social cooperation. So yes, there is communism as there is capitalism, there's no problem, but this is not a tendency, something which, you know, will happen. It's here and now, and it's a terrain of struggle against other measuring processes. Okay, so that's the key thing. And these are the key points, I think, that all these papers, in one way or another, bring up. And that leaves a couple of two big open questions. One linked to one of the themes of this conference, which is that if there is a point in what we are arguing that actually even in cognitive capitalism there are ongoing measuring processes by capital, what is the consequence of this to the basic income argument? Okay, we just some of the authors are putting forward, which depends on the idea that in fact the immaterial labor is unmeasured, is beyond measure. Okay, and I open that as a question. Okay, I don't want to bring down to it, but just open up the question there. And of course, again, if what we are arguing is actually makes sense in the experience of what goes on, is what is the consequence of our thinking for the struggles, the processes of political recompositions, the question of alternatives, again, very broadly defined. So it is a question, again, of immaterial labor as the pinnacle, as we were saying yesterday, of a class composition, or, as Nick was saying yesterday, to think immaterial labor laterally or horizontally in relation to other forms of labor. We actually share the same measuring processes in a different forms, you know, in a completely different form. There is a problem of recomposition going through that the facing of that big enemy, so to say. You know? What are we up against? The measuring process of capital and the value practices of capital. So we'll leave it there, and we actually go on. Thank you. But we need a chair to ask for. No, and a chair here, some neutral to define for. Would you have a chair volunteering here, a neutral person? You want to volunteer chairing?
No. Oh,
thank you.
How long have you got?
Yeah, a neutral chair to.
I think got
20 minutes.
Yeah. Well, a chair as well as a two chairs.
Yeah, 20 minutes. Yeah, chair for you. You haven't ever seen that. Get the grab around.
Okay, I suggest that we have three or four questions because there are a lot of people who want to ask questions. So we take them in groups. One here, one question there, one at the back, and. Actually, you had just been on, so I think, can you wait? The one at the back. Yeah, you were speaking before. So, one there. Woman there. Yeah, is your hand up? You're the second question. And then this gentleman here. So, in that order.
I think it's interesting that the title of the conference is Immaterial Labour, and stratification is a word that's been cropping up again and again and again in these 2 days of discussion, because I think that shows precisely the need for a collective theoretical and practical enterprise to actually see what is going under this concept and how we can refine the theoretical tools that we have now to apprehend what we're trying to describe. I actually started this conversation with Yang about an hour ago outside. I understand immaterial labor under very specific conditions, which are the ones described by Gabriel Pert when he talks about the difference between truth values and material goods. And he says, when you're talking about truth values, you're under a regime of free disposition, which means you're talking about goods that are intangible, they are intelligible, they are, I jotted this down here so that I could remember it, unappropriable, unexchangeable, because when you give a truth value, you don't lose it. That's basically the idea behind it. So you're beyond the regime of scarcity. You're beyond the regime of destructive consumption. Now, in the case of the waitress, I can't see how the waitress is beyond destructive consumption. Because even if we go back to the sloganized definition of effective labor is selling with a smile. You only give one smile to one customer. You don't give a blanket smile to all the customers, and that's enough. Well, yeah, it depends. It depends on the kind of establishment where you're working. So I think there is a question about the technical composition of the glass there. Where I would say, and especially now looking at the case of university lecturers, which I would think, oh, no, these guys are okay, they're immaterial. Actually, come to think of it, the research work can be classified as immaterial, but the teaching work cannot, because it still can be measured because it's under the regime of destructive consumption.
Could you finish there?
Okay. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
A lot of questions.
A lot of people.
One at the back. That's a very good question. This man here.
Yes, hi, my name is Alan. I just wanted to comment on some things. I think that it's an excellent point to say that value is never natural. Maybe it was natural when it had to go, but it's sort of politically closed in different ways. There is also, there's something said here about that now you try to measure value. Effect and meaning. I mean, from my experience, I've been mostly working with brands and advertising and cultural industries and some things. And there you have a very long tradition of measuring effect and meaning, which actually goes back to the 30s with the ABCD typology for advertising audiences, eyeballs, and so on and so forth. But what characterizes the crisis of measuring that field is that there is a whole series of attempts to measure things. You have PR companies that try to measure the economic value of sort of say, viral marketing or event marketing and so forth. And I would say it's a brand valuation companies like Indie Brand that try to kind of impose a common value on what is essentially an unmeasurable quality, the type of attention and solidarity that consumers give to brands. But the thing that characterizes that is that there is no unified measure. And people within the business don't really want the unified measure either. So maybe the composition of, it's not that we couldn't measure ideas or effects before, but it's rather that before the measurement of ideas and effects entered within a sort of a unified common measure, which we don't have today, or
with data. Very good. Could I propose to the speakers, those who want to speak to any of these questions, you have 2 minutes. We're going to measure, I will measure, and I will ask you to wind up. Okay? You have 3 questions to answer. You can answer them in
each. Yeah.
2 minutes to each to reply. I would suggest you pick one question.
Responding to the woman at the back, I agree that the migrant crossing borders produces value, and yes, and that's why economists study migration and talk and try and estimate quantitatively the value to GNP growth and so on, of immigration and so on, and they do try and measure this stuff. I think... Okay. When you ask about the ontology of living labour and so on, I think what Hart and Negri have forgotten is that Marx talked about a distinction between labour and work, where work means activity. Now, when Hart and Negri talk about living labour, I'd rather we talked about life activity. And there's a distinction between life activity and labour. And this is the problem with the ontology of empire.
Sorry, Enrica, okay. Can I come back to you? Yeah. Sorry, can I address exactly that point?
Yeah.
On Enrica, I see what coming from the Italian milieu, I think I know what Enrica is talking about in that sense. Yeah, I know, but it's, the point I want just to make an example, yes. I think I know what you mean when migrant crosses border produces value. I work with migrants and non-migrants. There is an exchange of effect, experience, and all that, and that produces value. Now the question becomes: value, whose value, and what for value? And then I give you another example of migrants producing value. The same mates who I become friends with now, working as cleaners, and being detained, threatened, and actually deported, put in detention camp, because they've organized, okay, essentially the tools of the migration laws used to actually threaten the others, to say, look, don't get organized because you're getting in trouble. Now, that is a particular form in which a different type of measures operates. Okay? And through that mechanism, you actually keep down wages, keep down, it goes back to absolute surplus value at that point. Okay? So, in that sense, living labor is what Marx was talking about. And I'm not dismissing the other meaning you give to living labor, which I actually prefer, as David talk about life, not to confuse it categorically, theoretically with this, because otherwise everything becomes labor. So that's the thing. So we have to keep them distinguished. Of course, they are both important. You have to look at the complementarities between the two.
Very good.
I wanted to also respond to the living labor question, because one of the things that I really struggled with when reading Immaterial Labour is precisely this problem, that it's not, we can have a reading of it as living labour, and obviously authors do, particularly Hart and Negri, for example, do refer to living labour as well, but they also at the same time try and put all of this other stuff under immaterial labour as well. And this was my contribution here, to look at, well, what does it mean if we put service work underneath this kind of concept of immaterial labour, then what does this actually mean? And this is what we find. And that's why I think it's absolutely crucial that we try and disaggregate what it is exactly we're talking about. I think that precisely comes back to the question of this lateral thinking, and that we are still looking for this pinnacle. And at the same time, we're also essentializing that if there is a shift from using material labour to immaterial labour, then that means there is an objective or essential shift in the way that the world works. And I think that is the problem as well, which also comes back to the issue of there is no unified measure. But it doesn't mean that measure doesn't still happen. But again, how do we respond to that, and what can we use? And right now we're responding with universalising concepts instead of responding to that particular.
Very good. Now, with three more questions, another group. You've had a lot to say. You might get a chance later. Woman there. Man there with a bottle. And one
come
behind.
On, right.
Who's holding a bottle?
It's all right. You'll come back. We've got time. Yeah, someone on the right. Andrea. Later. We've still got time. We've got another 10 minutes.
That's important to mention.
So, three questions. Where are we? There. There and there.
Mine's a really simple question, and it goes to all of this in terms of I still want to question the politics underneath it all. And I think that's what both these papers, and especially Emma's, raises, is how do we articulate struggle? If we are going to name this sort of
Next.
Right. I want to go back to the analysis of Christian today about UK and the US future. Yes, I really appreciate this view that exactly dependent on both of these things and not just the one. And so it needs the creativity, it needs the innovation, it needs to capture our life, as it were, and capture the creativity of our life in order to then measure it and reappropriate it and researchalize it, etc. But it needs both.
Okay, next. Third question. Behind. Yeah. Yeah.
No.
Yes.
I don't understand why, how capital measures unwasteful. You said before that every labor that contributes to creation of value is measured in capitalism. But how is unwasted labor measured? And if it was measured or it is measured nowadays, then why there are movements that still demand a wage?
Okay. 2 minutes each. Who's first?
I guess I've had a direct question, so I shouldn't respond to the house. I completely agree with Stefan that capital is both about the measure and the beyond measure. I mean, you can understand it's almost like it's the distinction almost between labour and labour power, or, you know, capital is always dependent on our creativity, so I completely agree. I think the emphasis with much of the debate about cognitive capitalism has been about beyond and not how capital captures that. In terms of capital measuring unwaged work, anybody who's parents now, your experiences of parenting are very different now from 20 years ago. When I was a child, I didn't have homework 20 years ago. When I was a child, when I was at school, at primary school, I didn't have homework. I had very little homework. When I was at secondary school, now a child, even in primary school, has homework, which their parent is supposed to help them do. There's this contract between the parents and the school that where the parent is supposed to help the child do their homework. Mothers have been imprisoned for allowing their child to go truant. This is how the unwaged labour of parenting, say, is measured and managed.
The activity, just to quote a statistic, in the UK, the activity of self-managed play has fallen for children, has fallen from 50% of the time to 20% of the time. Supervision is, I mean, there is a lot of pressure to supervise children to adults' time. But that has been studied there. That is, I mean, a classical example, another of measuring unwaged work is job search. But you have to just look how in the last 20, 25 years, the transformation of the welfare state, the entire activity of getting people to look for a job produced weekly evidence that you actually have done so many, response to many job interviews, etc., etc. That is a complete, it's ongoing work which is measured by a bureaucrat.
And retrieve it if you want to collect an employment.
There it is. I mean, there is endless examples of this if you have started to look into it. And it has been increasing enormously in the last
Our appearance is increasingly important. We have to look a certain way when we go to work, wear makeup, the shade, certain body type. That involves work, going to the gym, personal grooming and so on.
Okay, David, you make Emma.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that is... it's Emma. But that just reminded me of the grooming standards at work, where there's a whole list of grooming standards which are a real intervention into your project. Yeah, they're called grooming standards. You feel like a horse, you know. No offence to animal rights people, but we have to have clean shaven underarms and clean shaven legs at all times. I mean, have to shower every day, all of these kind of things. So a real active intervention in people's personal lives. But I think that's not so much the problem, because I think it's very easy for us to understand the control, the domination element of things, and how it really goes to the heart. And you were also saying, that's one of the things that you've been talking about. But beyond that, this measure issue, the struggle around that, I think is the point. And what Stefan was saying about, is it also is it about being beyond measure and measure as well, is where is the site of struggle in that? Where is the negotiation, not necessarily negotiation, but what happens often is a negotiation where, like for example, in the company where I worked, it's not about these people of like waiters producing affect and then the company coming in. It's this guy who set up this company set out his whole plan of action that then people come into. So where is the site there? Like that's really, I think, the crucial point.
Very good. Now I'm going to be a very indulgent chairperson. There were three other speakers earlier who put their hands up. I will allow those three, so it's Jan, Andrea, and yes, a colleague over there, 1 minute to ask a question. So you've got to be very sharp.
Yeah.
And then I think if there are 2 minute responses, that would take us right to time, if not just a little bit over.
Yeah,
1 minute.
Yeah, I think that measurement is the result of the existence of a wealth, of an health, which is not still value, economical value for capitalism. And this health produced this life value. Naturally, you have an attempt to measure it, and you always have it. But cognitive capitalism, when you were talking about a networking, they want to control you. But what they are interested in appropriating for themselves the else produced by your own networking. And finally, I will finish by one question. I have one question. The first was a statement. When you trace this framework of, let's say, Fordization of education, it has nothing to do with cognitive capitalism. It has to do to control or industrialization of production of knowledge. You have forgiven the real problem they are working on. And what is this problem? This problem is innovation. How could you produce innovation? And it's not because you measured that kind of measure. You will discover very soon that it destroys innovation. Hence, it destroys value. So the problem cognitive capitalism is changing on that respect is in perpetual war with what? With the traditional industrialists who think they will produce innovation just as you produce tanks or a bottle of wine.
Very good. Colleague.
I moved some months ago from Germany to the UK.
Control.
Of command. It is a managerial problem. And I don't want to make an accusation because I really need a thing that we need. I really think that we need a systematization of how control, how measurement operates today. But there must be a difference, or we must be able to make the difference between the techniques of measurement which the commando imposes on us and the way we produce and the way we communicate, the way we exchange, the way we affect each other, the way we change knowledge. These are two very different perspectives. You take the perspective of control, and that's okay, but it's not the perspective of the working, it's not the perspective of the
okay. Just one question.
30 seconds. I agree with Dimitris. I agree with all the other things you talk about the university. I think that the question is, what do you think of this sentence? That the last heuristic sector nowadays operating is the education sector.
Okay, now Ada's given me a note that says time to finish. So what I will do, the questions were fairly clear. So can it be more or less yes, no? You can give a couple of phrases to back up your yes or your no.
Okay.
Yeah.
I wanted to respond to Jan about the innovation. I think where is innovation coming from? And I think my problem is that we are very categorical about what we're saying. We say innovation comes from here, innovation comes from there. In the example that I gave, the innovation for this didn't come from the workers, from the creation in commons. It came from the capitalist who had the capital, who set up, who copyrighted his values, who set up the whole process, and in came the workers to adhere to that. Not just adhere, but embody it for them. And I'm not disputing the underlying thesis, but I'm saying that this categorical kind of characterization is problematic.
So there's no continuous improvement or innovation in that situation, that restaurant. 5 years' time, nobody will go to eat there. Next.
I wasn't quite clear what Jan's point, I didn't think it was that clear, but I'm not saying this is what all this measure stuff. I'm not saying it's good. I agree that this measure will stifle and does stifle innovation and creativity. That's the contradiction of capitalism, or one of the contradictions. But the fact is, management scientists, executives, they are managing innovation. There are numerous management science textbooks written on how to manage innovation. They are doing this stuff.
And they're failing.
Okay, I answer in the front from Andrea in degree of length of the answer. The last you asked, the last theory second education is education sector. The answer is no. We'll talk about it.
Okay.
Dimitris, there's a difference between technique of measurement that we were talking about and ways of communication. Absolutely. There is a clashes of different measuring processes. The clash is fundamental. That is should be our eye. That's the front line. That's the front line. And Jan, I think, look, your intervention is a statement and a question. The statement, life value created naturally through communications, etc., etc. Well, going to what we were talking about, I mean, we may be right or wrong, but given through our experience, your statement is quite ideological to us, because actually what goes on, what is produced there is the result of both our struggles, our own values to things, and the management's ways to measure. What ends up there, what is out there, the tendency, is the end result of their struggle. And to answer your question, innovation, how can we produce innovation through this type of measurement? Well, that's the point. Measure, yes, destroys innovation. That's exactly what we say. But what type of innovation? You know, that's the point. What type of innovation? We have that struggle. We have that struggle every single day. And thesis, don't be a pain in the ass, please, just say.
Okay.
No, the point is that the measure destroys innovation, yes. But the problem is that the way we have to innovate before and faster than others to get a market share, to meet that deadline, to beat that benchmark. It's not just innovation and knowledge in abstract. It's measured knowledge and measured innovation that has a particular political and economic effect on there. Get the market share, get more than the others, etc. So it's not abstract knowledge or innovation. It's knowledge innovation within a class struggle, which is, of course, new subjectivity, new conditions, and whatever. But that's the continuity. We go back to 100 years and still there. That's what is continuing.
Excellent, Massimo. That's the continuing.
Thank you to everyone for doing that. Thank you to Dave for chairing it. Excellent.
Thanks for being here.
character. We got a long history, me and him going back. 5 points, which I shall make briefly, Mr. Chairman. The first thing is, if anyone can find a longer extension cable for this to the mains, it might be useful. I don't know where we're going to find one. If anyone can do that, that's good. Second thing is, if anyone wants to go to the market, which is 300 yards over there, and buy a lot of fruit, bread and cheese, come to me, I'll give you some money, get some stuff, put it on the tables out there for the later breaks. We have good bread in the market, Jan. Good bread. Next, accommodation. Yeah. This colleague here, you know, have you noticed how I'm using the word colleague and not comrade in my discourse? This colleague here needs a room for tonight. If anyone can help with his problem for a room for tonight, see him. I hope you can.
Is a comrade or a colleague?
Okay. So, two people need help with accommodation tonight. Next, on the question of measure, according to my little list, 25% of the people attending this conference have not actually paid for their registration. I would like to encourage speakers do not pay registration, just in case you were wondering. Other people who have not paid their registration, I would appreciate it if you could come and see me and pay. The final point is that in 10 minutes from now, some of us are going to go on the river. If any of you would like to come on the river with us in two small boats, you are very welcome to do it.
England.
Josh, moment, quiet. Josh, everyone. Josh.
On that, could I have two or three people to help me bring the boats?
Yes. Where are they now? Queens. Yeah, we'll come down. The other point is that we will start at 2:45 on the dot.